Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Our brain is our body's control center. It's vital throughout our life. It governs everything from thinking, movement, motions, memories. As we age, keeping our brain sharp becomes even more important. A healthy brain helps us maintain independence, navigate daily tasks, and stay socially engaged. By incorporating brain-boosting activities like learning new things, staying physically active, and getting plenty of good sleep, we can help our brain stay resilient and adaptive for years to come. In the new book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brain, Minds, and Bodies, noted psychologist and author Arturo E. Hernandez reveals the ways to boost brain power by developing new skills, including new languages. Hernandez teaches how to take full advantage of our brain's plasticity and open our minds to its fullest potential. And Arturo Hernandez joins us now. And Dr. Hernandez, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you, David. Thank you for inviting me.
So talk about, you know, you focus on bilingualism. And what does that do for the brain? You know, learning new languages, working in different languages, how is bilingualism so important for the brain?
I've studied bilingualism for many years. And as I note in my book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies, basically bilingualism in a way is sort of supercharging the language system, right? So you're having to listen to different sounds, you're having to take those sounds and connect them to different things in the world. You're having to talk to different people who speak different languages. And so all of those things are sort of a superpower that sort of charges up the language system to work, you know, efficiently, effectively, but also, of course, with a little bit more effort in some cases.
People think that you're too old to learn a new language. Have you found that to be true?
You're never too old to learn anything, I would say, first of all. And secondly, definitely not too old to learn a new language. Now, we do have to note, right, that when people get older, they change, right? So a young infant learning a language is different than someone who's retired. But that doesn't mean that the retiree can't learn a new language. Of course they can.
So how many languages do you speak?
I speak four. So I speak Spanish and English. I learned simultaneously as a child, Portuguese as a young adult, and then German I learned in my 30s.
Were this out of just, you know, learning to learn, or were they learning for necessity?
Well, the Spanish and English was, I guess, necessity. My parents, you know, would send me to Mexico with family during the summer. English was spoken in the U.S., so I learned both of those. That was just by my environment. Portuguese, I fell in love with Brazilian music, and I decided I wanted to go abroad, and so I learned it, I guess, out of love, so to speak. And German was because I went many times to do research there, and I decided that I wanted to learn a fourth language, and that was quite challenging.
Well, did you find that, you know, the fact that you could speak multiple languages already, one more, you said it was challenging, was it because it was so different?
Yeah, German is different. The way I describe German is it's, for me at least, it's kind of like English without any Spanish. And what I mean by that is English has these Latin words, you know, words like tempest, like augment. And those words I could kind of bring in from Spanish and I could pull them into Portuguese too, but German doesn't operate that way. German actually operates really differently. They take really simple words and they compound them. And that took me a long time to figure out, like, how do I make a word in German? Because it's so different.
So as the director of laboratory for the neural basis of bilingualism at the University of, where is that, in California, the University of California, or in Houston?
That's in Houston.
In Houston. Can you actually look at the brain, like, you know, and be able to tell if this is a bilingual brain?
Yeah. Well, we can, because if we ask bilinguals to listen to each of their languages, the brain activity for each of their languages will actually reflect quite a big areas of the brain. If we ask someone who doesn't speak a language to hear a language they don't know, right? So if a monolingual in this case could hear a different language, the brain activity will be way reduced. So we can actually tell by the brain activity and how big it is whether someone actually knows a language pretty well or not.
So being able to hear the language and understand it seems to be the last thing that you develop when you're language learning. Is that right?
So understanding is difficult because it goes quickly. I think the hardest part is actually talking, right? So it's actually producing language. That's really hard because you're not just having to gather up what people are saying and sort of interpret it. You're actually having to formulate in your head, what am I going to say? And then you have to get your mouth to move and to produce the words that are actually going to come out of your mouth. And that actually producing is really the hardest part.
And then there's dealing with the embarrassment of getting it all wrong.
Well, I mean, not only getting it wrong, but also sometimes we get it right. I found this has happened to me in German where I actually say the right thing and then I correct myself in the wrong and I make myself wrong, which is kind of ironic.
So that seems to be the thing that people kind of, it's a barrier for folks. You know, they say that's why kids can learn languages so easily, that they're in a position where they can be wrong, because you expect a child to be able to, you know, they're learning, it's a kid. But adults, you know, they hinder themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I've thought a lot about that. And listening and thinking of my own language learning, or thinking about other people that have talked to me about language learning, we oftentimes think that we should speak in this new language the way we speak in our native language or native languages, and that's just not a realistic expectation. The expectation should be that we should speak better, and I try to sort of make a point of that in my book, that if we start small, if we think about improvement, that we can actually have measurable improvement in small steps. And that's a better expectation about how to eventually gain mastery than trying to think about how much we don't know.
Right. So, and how would that apply to language learning?
So in the case I actually did my own, when I learned German, I did my own little case study of how I wanted to do it. So I would actually, at the time there were CDs, and I would ride around in my car for the same reason, because I couldn't speak, and the CDs would spit out German, and my job was just to repeat whatever the CD was saying. And so I would do this a lot, repeating a lot. I also read some, but mostly focusing on the sound bits, just so that I could get my mouth comfortable with moving in a really kind of canned way, because it wasn't, you know, flexible, but at least I could say some things quickly without thinking about it. And so I kind of trained myself that way.
We're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation about mastery, how learning transforms our brains and minds and our bodies, keeps our brains sharp as we age. And you can develop really cool new skills. How do you feel about, you know, your brain and keeping it fresh as we get older? What are your tricks, and how have you been language learning? How has being bilingual, how do you think it's helped your brain stay fresh throughout the years? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Arturo Hernandez. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Houston, author of the new book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies. He's also has written the book, The Bilingual Brain. We invite you into our conversation. The number is 833-877-8255. Let's go to our caller. We have Sandra on the line. And Sandra, you're on the air.
Hi. I was fluent in French for many years. I studied at university, and I lived in French-speaking Africa. But when I came home and started life in a different direction, I lost a lot of it. And I find what I do now is if I'm cooking dinner, I try to recreate the meal and the menu in French. Sometimes I will just think in French when I'm doing something, and every once in a while I'll dream in it.
Wow. Good tip there. Thank you for that, Sandra. So, Arturo Hernandez, what do you think about Sandra's story there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great story. I actually... It turns out the science tells us that people feel like they've lost this language, right? So they don't speak it anymore, and it's kind of not the way it was before. And I've experienced that myself, and the science has shown that in fact, when time passes, people don't speak it as well. But the science has also shown that people who knew a language when they were younger have amazing abilities to actually recover it. And one of the interesting things about memory is that we do lose our memory. So when something happens a long time ago, right, and time passes, our memory starts to go down a little bit, but we can actually recover it quite well. So my sort of idea for you would be to let go and actually embrace and see how far you might be able to get back the French that you had. And my guess would be that you would actually be quite successful, maybe more than you would expect.
If you consumed media in that language, like watch a French foreign film that has not been translated, is it the consumption of it? Is that going to, I mean, do you have to engage and be interactive with it?
Interaction helps. Obviously, the best thing is to talk to a person and have them speak and you reply. But what I would say for sure is that any kind of language exposure is going to be a net plus. So watching films, reading any kind will be helpful. Even listening to streams on like audio streams in the background when we're doing our work. Every kind of language exposure helps, and certainly watching films would help too.
Now the caller, let's go to Danny. And Danny, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi. A little background on me. So Defense Language Institute, the DOD maintains its own cadre of folks that are able to, you know, were trained, able to speak in those languages. There was an ongoing joke that if you speak three languages, you're trilingual. If you speak two languages, you're bilingual. And if you speak one language, you're most likely an American. And based on that, as a child, being bilingual, I being a Panamanian, wasn't exposed to some of the restrictions that a lot of Mexican kids had, in the sense that they weren't allowed to speak Spanish at home. Whereas a child, you just see it as one big vocabulary as opposed to a different language. So what that aids you in is the ability to communicate without having the restriction of, oh, we'll only use this type of vocabulary, which is English, in the home, because that'll benefit you later. When in fact, kids don't have that membrane, in the sense that they don't separate, oh, that's English and Spanish. It's just all one big vocabulary. I use some here. I use these with my friends. I use these at school, and I use these at home. What is your understanding of language assimilation as a child ages, in the sense that it's my understanding that around 8 or 10, the brain starts to remap itself away from the ability to easily assimilate new languages, and as you get older, and if you haven't developed those synapses as a child, it becomes that much more difficult.
All right, Danny, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So, Arturo?
Yeah, so I mean, what I tell people always is every age is different, right? So 0 is different than 3, different than 5, different than 8, different than 12, different than 22, different than 52, different than 72. Every age is different. And every age comes with its sort of challenges and its sort of helpful parts. I think in terms of the young child, obviously, if somebody wants to speak with very little accent, then I would say earlier is better, right? Accent seems to be really marked by when you learn a language, not just non-native accents, also regional accents, right? In a native language, people can tell where they're from by where they grew up and the way they speak. So So that's really early. That window closes pretty early. It depends on the person. Some people, the window might close earlier, 4 or 5. Some people can keep it open till 10, 12, and can still sound like a native speaker, even learning the language at 12 or 14. There are some few people who can do that. So I would say in terms of an accent, for sure, there's a big age marker. The other stuff actually is surprisingly, people can learn quite a bit of vocabulary in a foreign language up till any age. They can learn the grammar pretty well. I mean, not perfectly. It gets a little bit harder. There's always little things about grammar that are harder. But vocabulary and grammar can be learned, and people can be pretty functional in a foreign language up till a pretty, advanced age. I would say definitely retirement age. They can become functional in a foreign language. The accent, the sound part, that's a little trickier. That we can tell. But again, right, an accent is just a way that we speak. It doesn't mean that we can't speak and be understood.
Well, the thing about grammar is interesting because, a native speaker they don't know about, passive voice, subjunctive. This is how you say this in this circumstance. So they don't, like in English, I don't know all the rules. I just know what sounds right. So is focusing on grammar in learning Spanish or any other kind of language, and rather than just like, well, this is what sounds good, is that, learn the musicality of the voice in the circumstance, what seems to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we kind of get into the story of who you are, right? So I think if you're a person who has a musical ear and you're a person who can sing, right, in tune and maybe a musician, we know that vocalists, right, people who sing, right, vocally, are the best imitators of non-native accents, right? So they can do that very well. And they probably will learn the grammar through a sound-based kind of approach, because that's kind of what they do in their profession or in their, very advanced hobby. For other people, grammar becomes like a book, right? They know all the rules and they have to learn that way because their ear may not be as musical. They may not be as able to sing. And so they learn the rules in a rule-based kind of way. You can go either way. People who are really good, these are like polyglots, so people who speak multiple languages. And I do talk a little bit about this polyglots and people who speak multiple languages, 11, 15 languages. They seem to be able to do both. They can get a feel for the language. They kind of know what the rhythm and musicality is, and they can step outside and do the rules. But those are really, really the exceptions. For the majority of people, I think they can do one or the other. What I would say, though, is that all adults learning definitely benefit from instruction. So for them, the instruction really helps.
So how is it that learning new languages, that's just one skill. You talk about a lot of different skills in your book, Mastery, how learning transforms our brains, minds, and bodies, including music and competitive sports. But, how do these benefit the brain?
Well, I mean, the brain is a learning machine, right? It will, whatever, and this is what I tell people, whatever task that we have to do, whether it's a new sport, it's chess, it's a new instrument, it's a new language, it could be even, people want to now go back to school and maybe they want to learn computer science, coding. Right? They want to learn how to do something new. Our brain will take on new tasks. It will adapt to whatever's in our environment for us to learn. And that's a benefit for the brain, right? Our brains are really wired to learn new things. That's kind of an interesting, different way to think about learning compared to the way we normally think about it.
Right. So that will bring about, we talk about the brain's plasticity. That's something that 50 years ago, people didn't think actually existed. But now we know that, and when we thought that the brain did not develop new neurons throughout life, that you were born with a certain set of brain cells and you would just lose them throughout life. But now we know you can grow new brain cells. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we can grow new brain cells. Of course, the period of, you know, most growth is before birth, right? So that's like an overproduction of neurons. But yeah, the thinking was before that it just stopped, right? And all neurons just died from there. But, and there is also neuronal loss, but there are gains. We can actually grow new neurons as we get older.
So what are some of the things we can do to, you know, foster brain development in later in life?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, so the brain development later in life, of course, is not the same as when we're young. Young is when we have the largest, you know, production of neurons. But there are lots of things, and the way I like to think about the brain, we will get new neurons, but really the biggest benefit for us would be thinking of the brain, right, and brain health as being part of the body, right? And so in the book, I do talk about the fact that our brains are part of our bodies, and that everything that's good for our physical health is good for brain health. And if we improve our health in general, that will improve our cognition, our ability to actually do, learn new things, do tasks.
Well, you know, in our general health, we can talk about, so in the gut microbiome, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, having a healthy biome is good for, you know, your body. But now there's a drawing a connection between the gut microbiome, and there's also apparently a microbiome in the brain, and that they communicate, and that's all connected. And having a good diet, plant-based diet with a multiple different types of plants is good. Do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the, it's kind of a side story, but the one of the key phrases in the book that I use is called the emergence of skill. And so emergentism is this idea that when you put things together, they become more than they would have been separately. So a really simple example would be something like if you put hydrogen and oxygen, right, those are two gases, they become water, which, and water is a liquid. So if we think about that in terms of the brain and the body, right, our bodies, a lot of times we think of the brain as being separate, but in fact, everything is interconnected in our body. And what happens in one system affects the other. And that's a property of what they call an emergent system. And if we think about our thinking, our skill learning as an emergent system, then we realize that things that we might have thought were not connected to our learning or our ability to learn something new can be connected. And those are physical things.
And also I've seen that, you know, learning multiple things simultaneously is actually a benefit to learning. Is that, do you see that?
So can you define, like, maybe?
Well, one thing I read about is like trying to learn multiple languages at once rather than focusing on one, try and learn Spanish and French together, and you will see connections and that they will build upon each other. And, you know, that's and you will have, you know, mastery sooner of two languages rather than just one.
Spanish and French are good are interesting examples because they're both Romance languages, right? They're both derived from Latin. So in that case, I would say, yeah, there are shared words between, even shared kind of like grammatical things between French and Spanish that could help one another and could, in the end, right, in a long period of time, help to augment learning. The only, of course, tricky thing, of course, is we always want to be making progress. And so as long as somebody's making progress, I think, yeah, you could learn too. Why not?
All right. And I've heard it compared, learn tennis and pickleball at the same time. All right. But let's talk about more. We're going to talk about tennis and how mastery of tennis is, can be also a good thing. I know that's one of your faves. And our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This is The Source talking about brain health. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Our topic today, brain health. keeping your brain sharp by learning new things throughout your life. We're joined by Arturo Hernandez. He's professor of psychology at the University of Houston, author of the new book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies. His previous book is The Bilingual Brain. We invite you into the conversation, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So, Arturo, if you don't do any of these things, if you're just not challenging yourself, you're watching the same old episodes of Gunsmoke over and over again, what does that do to you?
I mean, I think there's some pleasure, right, in watching the things that you like to watch. And I think the enjoyable part of being able to watch old episodes, to have old memories, to get those feelings of maybe your childhood or a period in the past. The brain and our minds will take us to that place and we'll experience it quite well. Of course, in an ideal world, we would want to challenge ourselves, but sometimes I think for some individuals, what they want to do is be in the best emotional, like, you know, feel the best that they can. And I think if watching Gunsmoke brings them really good feelings, they should continue doing it.
But they're not getting, you know, stimulating new parts of the brain, are they?
That is correct. Yeah. So if we engage in the same tasks that we've always engaged in, then of course we're not doing new things, and doing new things does enhance our brain, you know, capabilities, then yeah, that's true.
So do we have to develop the skill of being comfortable with being uncomfortable learning new things?
Absolutely, I would agree with that. I think that is the tricky part about learning something new, is that there will be a degree of discomfort. And that degree of discomfort, in many ways, for some people, it indicates that maybe they're not doing as well as they'd like to do. But from my perspective as a brain scientist, it indicates that we're actually doing something new. And the benefit of being somewhat uncomfortable is that we're expanding our brain capacity.
So why did you decide to take on this topic, mastery?
So mastery is a really interesting thing because, of course, my main area of research is language. And when I finished my first book, The Bilingual Brain, I had a chapter in there that was about being an expert and being better at something. And as time went on, I began to realize that a lot of the things that I was talking about, or that we talk about in terms of language, you know, how well we speak it, when we learn it, what kinds of mechanisms do we need to do, you know, to expand, right, effort, those types of things, also apply to skills in general. And that I could take some of the lessons I learned in that and put them into a discussion of how do we learn something new, because learning language taught me about how we learn in general.
Well, I mean, I wanted to push back on that. Why not think about it in the terms of embrace the suck? You know, learning, you know, towards mastery can be really intimidating, but figuring out like, well, I want you to just accept the fact that you're not going to be good at this, at least for the beginning, but you will enjoy it, and it'll be good for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tricky thing, right? We can, on the one hand, we don't want so much pressure that we decide we don't want to take this on at all. On the other hand, we don't want so little that we don't challenge ourselves. So the really tricky part, and I think the key part, is to be challenging enough, but not too challenging. And I think that sweet spot, when we can hit that one, where we have to embrace that sometimes we're not going to be as good as we expect to be, but that we are going to make progress. I think balancing those two things is important.
And so to get to mastery, you know, we have that, the journey of what, practice, you know, and what, so how do you practice to develop mastery?
My approach, and the approach that I discuss in the book, centers around a lot of starting small, right? So starting with small, achievable things that we can do on our road to mastery. So if it's, for example, if we wanted to learn a new language, we could practice some vocabulary. We could practice saying some simple, small phrases to get us started. If we're thinking of chess, we could think of chess moves, for example, simple chess moves that we're going to use. Eventually, we'll string those together into a chess game or into a conversation. But the point is to really start small with achievable goals, which is in a way what children do, right? They start small with achievable goals. I think as adults, we can use that strategy that children use, because that's they are smaller, to help us.
Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255, 833-TP-TALK. If you got a question or comment about brain health by learning new things and developing mastery in a new skill, let's go to Henrietta. Henrietta, you're on the air. Go ahead.
I am enjoying this show immensely because actually our whole body depends on the brain, a healthy brain, for its function. And I also wanted to know if he knows of a function in the lower back of the brain called, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, I think it's stemsensia.
All right, Henrietta, thank you for the call. Arturo Hernandez, do you know about that?
I didn't quite catch the word. I was trying to hear it through the...
I really didn't catch that either. But it brings up an interesting point about different parts of the brain, you know, and as we know, the brain is very segmented but interconnected. How do we, you know, take advantage of that?
So the brain, the way I've described it, and it's been described by others, is a sensory motor machine, right? So we have parts of the brain that are involved in our senses, what we see, what we hear, what we taste, what we touch, and then in producing, right, motor actions, right, movements. So our brains are separate into these sort of sensory areas, these motor areas, areas that actually are involved in the movement that we produce. And what we call more complicated thinking is actually a higher sort of combination of that sensation and movement, even simulated movement, right? So in our head, we kind of simulate something that might happen. And then when we actually conduct the action, we've actually simulated it in advance. So that's kind of like advanced thinking. So our brain is, in a way, a sensory motor, right? Computer machine.
But I've also heard the brain described as a pleasure sinking machine. And so if we connect the development of pleasure, feeling good about ourselves, and also doing something challenging, then you're probably more likely to continue challenging activities.
So there has been some work on this concept of flow. So I touch a bit on the concept of flow. This idea of flow was brought in by a psychologist, famous psychologist called Csikszentmihalyi, who found that when people did a task, it became pleasurable for them to the extent that they actually began to lose track of time. They lost track of what they were doing, and they were kind of so absorbed by the task that they kept doing it much longer than they expected. And some science has actually shown that, for example, musicians who practice more fall into flow when they're practicing, and they begin to actually find this task enjoyable and they improve. And I think the importance of flow, enjoyment, and moving in that sort of rhythmic way in a task it's really crucial for our improvement.
But as you mentioned, you know, using thinking about the practice, you don't actually have to do it physically, but you can think about the process of practice, but then also include in that how pleasurable that practice is. And then you're essentially programming yourself to enjoy this thing that you're trying to master.
Yeah, you can. You're tricking your mind, essentially. You're creating the situation, better way to say it, creating a situation or an environment in which you're going to improve because, yes, as you say, you're enjoying it and it's challenging. That's the irony. When it's challenging, you're enjoying it, and that's the sweet spot.
And so a person should reflect on things that they're trying to master, you know, after you've had a good practice, reflect on how great that was and how pleasurable it was and add on how awesome you are because you did that thing?
Absolutely. I think it's important for us to realize that, you know, a lot of times we have these big goals, right? We have these big things we want to do. But the little things oftentimes are really satisfactory, and we should embrace those and we should cherish those little things, because when we do these little things, right, as small as they may be, the next day, the next practice session, we'll be able to add to those.
Taking another break, we're going to continue our conversation talking about brain health, practicing difficult activities, developing mastery, keeping your brain healthy and sharp throughout your life. Got questions and comments, love to hear from you. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. When I come back, I want to talk to you about sleep, alcohol, and other terrible things that we do to ourselves. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, talking with Arturo Hernandez, professor of psychology at the University of Houston, director of Laboratory for the Neural Basis of Bilingualism, Department of Psychology, author of a new book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies. Also, his previous book is about the bilingual brain. So, Arturo, when we do things like deprive ourselves of good sleep, or we consume too much alcohol, we have a bad diet, or how does that impact in our brain health?
Negatively.
But how bad? Is it so bad that I should all, you know, think about changing some of my habits?
I mean, you know, the tricky part about science, I'll say this up front, right, is that the science changes, right? And nobody, a lot of times we're given an answer. So we know for sure, and I know this from my colleague here at the University of Houston, that binge drinking is not good. So drinking a lot, having a lot of alcohol in a very short amount of time is bad for the brain. It causes damage. It impairs learning. It impairs memory. It impairs, obviously, how we feel physically. So we know that that's true. We know that if we eat diets that are full of really bad fats, you know, a lot of processed foods, that's not good as well. We know that, you know, not sleeping, pulling all-nighters, especially, you know, sometimes, and I did this one time too, you know, pulled an all-nighter because I had a deadline. I actually had to produce something. It wasn't just studying. But we know that all-nighters are not good. Our bodies take a hit. Now, when people are younger, of course, that hit, the body's able to recover more quickly. It's slower to recover as we get older, but younger people, they can recover more quickly. But yeah, I mean, I think extreme things of, you know, alcohol, food, sleep are not good for the brain.
So that seems to be the issue of a dispute these days of like, say, okay, obviously over drinking, binge drinking is not good for your brain. But now they're saying the whole idea of moderate drinking is being addressed and say that's probably not good either, particularly if you're doing it just before you're going to sleep, because it could impact your ability to get a deep, restful sleep. And as when we sleep, our brain is doing a lot of work, particularly cleansing, you know, moving some of the toxins out of our brains. So there's a lot going on there, even with a moderate amount of alcohol. So what's your thought?
My thought is that, I always have a counter example. So let's say that, like, I'm not a binge drinker, right? But I really enjoy having beer with some friends. on Thursday night at 7 p.m. Okay, so maybe when I was younger, I would drink all the way to 10, 11. Now I want to drink at 7, so I might drink a little earlier. But that, you know, one beer that I'm having with my friends brings me all of this social connection. It brings me a moment when I'm with them. I don't need the beer to be socializing. And assuming that I don't have a doctor's recommendation that tells me I should not drink beer at all, that having one beer at 7 p.m. on a Thursday, so maybe this evening, right, with some friends might bring me this net benefit of being with my friends and of feeling really connected and happy. Do I have to have the beer? No. But the beer is that moment. So it's all the other things that come together with it. And I think when we think about these things that might be bad for us, so for example, I shouldn't have a hamburger because, you know, I know from my cardiologist that having a hamburger is not the healthiest thing. But every so often, I like to go down to In-N-Out. I'm a Californian originally. In-N-Out is from California. And when I go to In-N-Out, I have my cheeseburger because it reminds me of California and being a kid. And that's a positive thing. So I think we can do it in moderation, but it should be that there's a positive benefit emotionally, socially. And I think if that's really big, then it can outweigh the risk of having a little bit of something that's not so good for us.
Okay. So there are people who, or most people, or maybe all people, have a problem with negative thoughts, stinking thinking, being down on themselves. And is that having an impact on brain health? I mean, can people develop better habits of like what their inner monologue is?
So in the book, Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies, I have a chapter in there that's about the two selves, right? So the two selves are like the self that what I call the doer and the talker. The doer does stuff. It just does stuff. It sees a ball. So example, tennis, you're mentioning tennis earlier, right? The ball's there. I've got to hit it. There's no judgment, right? I just got to hit the ball. The talker says, oh, no, you're going to miss. The talker says, oh, no, you didn't hit it exactly the way you wanted to. And there's actually a section in the book where I reflect on this period where I was playing a tennis match. And it was at the end, and I guess I was nervous because I couldn't even move my hand. I had to physically, like mentally try to hit a shot and get the ball over the net because my hand was shaking. I must have been nervous, tired, dehydrated. And I was just amazed at the fact that instead of thinking like, wow, what's wrong with me? Why can't I hit a normal ball? I thought, that's amazing. Like my body cannot do this, even though I'm trying so hard. It was kind of a moment where I felt like, wow, I'm really nervous and tired. This is really hard. And I take it for granted. And so I think rethinking what those negative things are, what they're telling us, that's the trick. And for me, at least, what I've learned when I'm trying to perform something is to always be on my side, always feel whether I'm a little bit mad at myself because I didn't do as well as I wanted to, or whether I'm happy with myself, I'm always my biggest ally when I'm doing something. And I think when we do that, we find ways to try to even improve. And sometimes we might be a little bit mad at ourselves, and that's okay. But then we say, okay, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to get on the other side of this? And I think that that's the tricky part, getting our mind to work for us and getting those negative thoughts to help us, not to hurt us.
And just because you missed a shot doesn't mean that you're a terrible person. You know, it's a low stakes kind of a thing. You missed a shot. We got to keep things in perspective. It's all about really how you feel about yourself, and you should be your own biggest fan.
Definitely. I think that's the hard thing. And that's, you know, tennis is my hobby. It's what I've played. It's a sort of family sport. I talk about this in the book quite a bit about tennis, but for me, it's really been self-discovery. Like, how can I be my biggest fan when I just did something that might have been like, you know, I lost a match. And of course you're saying that's true. It is low stakes, right? But on the other hand, you know, you want to perform well. How can I still be on my side, even though it wasn't my best performance? And I think, you know, you kind of learn to forgive yourself and say, hey, well, you know, you put in the effort, you tried, but, you know, I'm still on my side. And Rafael Nadal, a really very famous tennis player, once said, you know, when he was playing Roger Federer in a match in 2008, he said, you know, Federer might beat me, but I will not lose. And what he meant by that is, if a person beats me, that's fine, but I will always be my biggest champion. I will always be on my side. And that's a really hard lesson to learn.
But there's a lot of good lessons in your book about mastery and how learning transforms our brains, minds, and bodies. But, you know, thinking a lot about as we age and you know, we want to take care of our brain health, and people are very concerned about dementia and Alzheimer's and things like that. But having this as a part of our active habit strategy throughout life, can we keep dementia and Alzheimer's at bay?
Dementia, Alzheimer's are, of course, I mean, physical ailments, right? They're brain diseases. They're still trying to understand what the causes of those are. Really, I think there are lots of experts who've written. There are lots of studies now looking at dementia and Alzheimer's, trying to figure out factors that may stave off or slow down dementia. My own visit to a conference in Austin a few years ago was surprising to me, because what I learned at that conference was that exercise in a person's 50s is one of the biggest predictors. And by exercise, we don't mean running a marathon, you know, hiking the tallest peak. We're talking about taking walks, even brisk walks, physical activity. That was really important for brain health, and it was very predictive of Alzheimer's in people's 70s or dementia in their 70s. So there are things that can be done. But of course, I'm not an expert in Alzheimer's. I'm not a medical doctor, and I think people should consult with them, because their science is evolving quickly, and there are things that people can do.
Yeah, but having good brain health, doing things that will spark neurogenesis, brain growth, can be things like social interaction. Even having a really good dog in the house can be things that can help you not only enjoy life, but continue to enjoy life.
A dog is an interesting one. Yeah, we got a dog during the pandemic, and the science that I know from dog walking is that there's a net positive, that people will go walk the dog when they wouldn't have normally walked. And I can actually attest to that personally, that's true.
And there's a benefit to that.
Yes.
So, these are not secrets. You know, you're telling us a lot of things that I think we all kind of know, but, you know, it helps to hear it from an expert like you, Arturo.
Thank you.
So Arturo is the author of the book Mastery, How Learning Transforms Our Brains, Minds, and Bodies, professor of psychology at the University of Houston, big proponent of learning new languages by the bilingual brains, another one of his books. Lots of ways to learn these days. Arturo Hernandez, thank you so much for coming on The Source today. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.